Gurvmahagata Vora, tonight on Arena. Thomas McCarthy and Richard Aldous on the poetry of Philip Larkin, and we review Bones in the Attic at the Hugh Lane Gallery. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. British poet Philip Larkin is famed for saying the unsayable, and that includes a judicious use of the F word. He is a poet that captured the reality of the time he lived in, writing poems about relationships, place and death. But crucially, his poems could also offer moments of beauty and transcendence. He was born in Coventry, but famously spent his adult life in Hull, working as a librarian. This year sees the 100th anniversary of his birth. To look back at the man and the poet who gave us such poems as The Whitsome Wedding and Obeyed, I'm joined by poet Thomas McCarthy and academic Richard Aldous. Thomas, as a fellow poet, how would you categorise the work of Larkin? Social realism, a chronicler of the age, or as some would say, maybe a little dismissively, a little Englander?
I would say a chronicler of a chronicler of the hateful age, where, as he says himself in The Less Deceived, you know, beneath it all, a desire of oblivion runs. It's a kind of life which is really a despairing Anglican humanism that informed his entire life, I think, and the way he looked at life.
And are you talking about the 40s and the 50s and on? Like the,
you could say that his mental weather was created by the 1940s in England. Remember, a time of incredible social pressure as England coped with the Second World War and all of the sacrifices that were required. Indeed, when he came down from Oxford himself, he was sitting quite happily idle and alone, and he got a letter from the Ministry of Labour asking him what contribution he was making to the war. And so he had to go and get a job. So in that sense, the state interfered with him very quickly to tell him that it had expected a contribution for him. And in a sense, his view of life and his own sense, if you like, of hopelessness, personal hopelessness, I mean, not literary hopelessness, because he was a brilliant poet. His attitude just created a certain type of personality, which appeared gloomy, although, you know, the memories of say, somebody like Kingsley Amis at Oxford remembers him playing the piano and singing those 12-bar blues, which he loved. He once said that jazz was the emotional life of the age, and he had that respect for jazz and an understanding of it. So he loved certain things like jazz and Margaret Thatcher, but most other things he didn't like.
Okay, jazz and Margaret Thatcher, that's a very strange mix. Richard, he had a very unhappy childhood, a lonely home, parents who famously effed him up, as they say. Tell us about, or as he said, tell us about those parents, particularly the dad.
Yes, hello, Kay. It was a very lonely childhood, exactly as you say. But in many ways, it was a childhood that had the contradictions that later emerged in his life. That his father was a quite an intolerant person on one level. He was a Nazi sympathizer, and yet this was the same father who introduced him to jazz, introduced him to the poets and novelists like D.H. Lawrence, for example. His mother was a very introverted person, very nervous person. And so a lot of the introspection and the glumness, I think, came from the mother's side. So it was an interesting mix. He didn't actually go to get formal schooling until he was 8 or 9 years old. So again, I think that sense of introspection and introversion kind of very much came from childhood. And exactly as Thomas says, it was really when he went to Oxford, ran into one of the great friendships of his life in Kingsley Amis, that he developed this kind of perhaps more outward-going personality.
Now, talking about his parents, I think it's appropriate that we would play the famous poem, This Be the Verse.
This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had. and add some extra, just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself.
This be the verse, the poem from Philip Larkin, and that came from his collection, High Windows. Thomas, yes, that time in Oxford seemed to have been a liberation for him, having hated life in Coventry with his parents. He was then able to have intellectual friendship like that with Kingsley Amis.
He did, and that friendship was crucial to him, I think. As I mean, Kingsley Amis writes so respectfully about him and kind of affectionately about him. But he came out of Oxford with a first, which means he must have been doing some work, even though he said he wasn't doing any work on the curriculum, mainly writing sort of comments, which were mainly hostile comments in textbooks owned by the college. But he hated Beowulf. Then he thought that Beowulf was the most hateful thing that had ever been written until he encountered the Fairy Queen. And then he thought that that was the most awful poem that had ever been written. So he kind of hated everything that was... But it's interesting to think that he introduced Kingsley Amis to At Swim Two Birds by Flann O'Brien. You know, so he was reading widely himself off the curriculum. So he was an intellectually curious person, despite the fact that he would make you want to think as his reader that he wasn't really that curious about anything that was unfamiliar.
He seemed to, Richard, to hate everything international, and then became, you know, accusations of being a little Englander, I think, comes from the idea that he had no great grow for travel or looking at the wider world.
I think as well that kind of part of that comes from his embrace of the provincial. It's not just this sense of the international. It's also a sense of London as well, and the metropolitan, that so much of his life, which is grows up in Coventry. Yes, then he goes to Oxford, but then he goes to Belfast and Leicester, eventually arrives in Hull, where he spends, you know, 30 years of his life and career. So it's very much that kind of sense of the local, the uncelebrated, the provincial life, ordinary life. And, you know, I'm thinking when Thomas was talking about his the way in which he very often would hide his intellectual lights under a bushel. This is kind of part of what his poetry was about, it seems to me, that although part of what he was doing was to try and get away from what he saw as the pretension of the modernists like Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot of the Wasteland and so on, to really get this kind of much more straightforward language, ordinary language, dealing with the everyday concerns of ordinary people in places that most people just simply couldn't care less about.
Yes, so Thomas, you think that his life in Hull, therefore, was a good place to feed that imagination and try and give him an individual voice?
Most definitely, because he found people in Hull, mainly his library staff. He was the director, he was the chief librarian at the Bryn Mawr Jones Library in Hull, and he was an absolutely brilliant librarian. He introduced many of the library systems that would later be used in all university libraries in Ireland and in England. He was very innovative. He was extremely good at managing committee meetings at a university level, and anybody who works in a university would see that that was an incredible skill. So he was very good with people. He befriended, and he had sort of on-off affairs with various people like Maeve Brennan, who became sub-librarian at the Bryn Mawr Jones Library. He had been engaged very early on in his life to Ruth Bowman, but then he met Monica Jones, and, you know, he met other people, Betty McCarrath, who was his secretary for 25 years, I think, or 28 years at Hull University. All of these people were incredibly loyal to him and thought immensely of him as a poet. And they loved his working with him in the library because he was a poet, which is really interesting. And I have my own memory.
You see,
my own,
that is familiar, yes. being a librarian and, well, a poet yourself, Thomas.
I love when he was asked in an interview in the mid 60s, you know, if he thought about what it was to be a librarian poet, and, you know, did he feel like Borges, the great Argentinian writer, you know? And he said to the interviewer, "Who's Borges?" You know, just pretending he didn't know who Borges was. But he said, no, he said, the only librarian I admire is Archibald MacLeish, who, of course, was the Librarian of Congress. But you would think that the administration of an incredibly busy university library system would have taken all of his time. Yet he was able to write reviews and become the jazz correspondent for the Daily Telegraph.
Thomas, I think that jazz is a key into listening to the work of Larkin and understanding how he wrote his poetry.
Most definitely. In fact, it's interesting the way he describes jazz as a folk art that became something universal and the emotional language of the age. And in a sense, he was trying to write English folk ballads in a way, but with the most profound thought in them. His politics as well, you know, are difficult to stomach. I mean, Evan Boland complained about his politics. She said she found High Windows, for example, almost impossible to read. It was so appalling. The prejudices in it were so appalling. But yet she had to admit the poetry was brilliant.
Let's listen to An Arundel Tomb now and listen for that jazz.
An Arundel Tomb. Side by side, their faces blurred, the Earl and Countess lie in stone, their proper habits vaguely shown as jointed armour, stiffened pleat, and that faint hint of the absurd, the little dogs under their feet. Such plainness of the pre-Baroque hardly involves the eye until it meets his left-hand gauntlet, still clasped empty in the other, and one sees, with a sharp, tender shock, his hand withdrawn, holding her hand. They would not think to lie so long. Such faithfulness in effigy was just a detail friends would see, a sculptor's sweet commissioned grace thrown off in helping to prolong the Latin names around the base. They would not guess how early in their supine stationary voyage the air would change to soundless damage, turn the old tenantry away. How soon succeeding eyes begin to look, not read. Rigidly they persisted, linked through lengths and breadths of time. Snow fell, undated. Light each summer thronged the glass. A bright litter of bird calls strewed the same bone-riddled ground. And up the paths the endless altered people came, washing at their identity. Now, helpless in the hollow of an unarmorial age, a trough of smoke in slow suspended skeins above their scrap of history, only an attitude remains. Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their final blazon, and to prove our almost instinct almost true. What will survive of us is love.
An Arundel Tomb there, read by the poet himself, Philip Larkin. Richard, Thomas touched there on his politics, and when it came to issues of race and his views on women, they're quite troubling.
I think this is one of the things that has emerged since his death with the publication of his letters. So there have been several volumes of letters, including letters to Kingsley Amis, but also the letters to his family, particularly to his mother. 4,000 letters, I think, were he wrote to his to his family. And yeah, I think this is one of the things that actually we have to come to grips with Larkin, that whilst he is an extraordinary poet, he is in many ways just an ordinary man of his time. So, you know, he was born in 1922. His last collection of poetry came out in 1974. And his letters display the kinds of attitudes that were really quite common for someone who comes into adulthood during the Second World War and the post-war era. So, yeah, a lot of the views on race, on women, are things that we find very difficult to deal with in the early 21st century. But as I say, it's that difficulty for us in trying to reconcile this extraordinary poet with these views that just seem so banal and yet so ordinary, so typical of their time.
Do you find those views hard to reconcile with the poet, Thomas?
I mean, I think sometimes the prejudices are part of the energy of the verse craft itself. He's being provocative. He knows he's being provocative because he knows that the literary public, particularly the poetry reading public, is would be predominantly left-wing or at least left-leaning and progressive. So he knows what he's doing. He knows the effect of what he's writing. And he's enjoying that effect, I think, while making very effective verse craft. I mean, his pessimism is sincere. Like, that is not an actor in any way. You know, that despairing humanism is what distinguishes him from, say, other Oxford graduates like Claude Coburn, for example, the great communist writer, you know, whose optimism was universal and lasted until Claude's death. And so therefore, he had none of the optimism of revolutionary thought in him, but he had the conservative pessimism. And I think that was overwhelming in him.
And which do you, Richard, think will poems of Larkin will endure the test of time?
I mean, I think there are so many that will endure, and there are so many lines that are part of our common language. Whether it's his reflection on the end of the First World War, that never such innocence again, the line that you quoted at the beginning, the kind of the coarser things like books are a load of crap, he says in one poem. But I'm kind of struck that, coming back to what Thomas said, that so often Larkin is in dialogue with himself. Yes, he often is baiting us as readers. But if you take a poem like High Windows, which has a lot of views that we find quite difficult to deal with at the beginning, where he's kind of talking about the passage of time and how young people seem to have all of the advantages mm-hmm. that he didn't have. Yet at the end of that poem, there's this incredible sense of the sublime where he contemplates from this high window the deep blue air that shows nothing and is nowhere and is endless. And that, I mean, that is, to use the word that you used before, a transcendent moment where suddenly, just for a second, he's managed to rise above all of the things that we've been talking about today, the glumness and so on. So, yes, there is that kind of conservative pessimism, but there is also a kind of a sense of struggling against it too.
Well, Richard Aldous and Thomas McCarthy, thank you so much for recalling the work of Philip Larkin on This Is Centenary. We'll finish with the first two stanzas of Obeyed, read by the poet himself.
I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time, the curtain edges will grow light. Till then, I see what's really always there, unresting death, a whole day nearer now, making all thought impossible, but how and where and when I shall myself die. Arid interrogation. Yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify. The mind blanks at the glare, not in remorse, the good not done, the love not given, time torn off unused, nor wretchedly because an only life can take so long to climb clear of its wrong beginnings, and may never, but at the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always. not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon. Nothing more terrible, nothing more true.
Philip Larkin reading Obeyed there. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena, and now to one of global cinema's most influential performers, a woman who was most famous as an actor, but successfully branched out into screenwriting, directing, producing, and even singing, becoming a best-selling recording artist in her native France. Jeanne Moreau was heralded as a star from her stage debut in 1947, and over the next 60 years, she worked with the who's who of 20th century's most acclaimed film directors. The likes of Orson Welles, François Truffaut, Louis Malle, Michelangelo Antonioni, Louis Bruniel, and Wim Wenders. She won Best Actress Award at Cannes, Venice and Berlin, two BAFTAs, two Césars, as well as an honorary Oscar. Let's hear her talking about her career. Here's Jeanne Moreau.
Though I didn't ask for it, my needs were such that they coincided with the needs of film directors. And the preoccupation at that time, who is a woman? Who is she? So there is a lovely phrase of Jean Cocteau. Ce beau mensonge qui dit la vérité. This beautiful lie tells the truth. I think it's really the mirror of the world.
Jeanne Moreau there, talking about her career, set to the music of Miles Davis, who composed the score for Lift to the Scaffold, the film that made her a star. With me this evening is Stephen Benedict to discuss the importance of Jeanne Moreau's contribution to cinema. Her career coincided with the Nouvelle Vague in France, but yes, that wasn't where her career started. She started in theatre.
She did. She made her stage debut in 1947, where she played Verochka in Turgenev's A Month in the Country. And throughout her career and throughout her life, she was looking for roles of thoughtful, resourceful, defiant women. She was a sensation from the start, but unfortunately her film career took about 10 years to get going because the producers did not have a clue what to do with her. If I can compare her career to Bette Davis, Bette Davis also began on theatre, and when she went out to Hollywood, she was beckoned by Hollywood, and when she went out there, she wasn't given the roles that she wanted to play, and so she sued Warner Brothers in 1936 for the right to choose her own roles. Now, when it came to Jeanne Moreau, the producers and the French producers in the 50s didn't think that she fitted in with their view of what a young French woman should be, which is an ingenue. And I think they eventually found that shape with Brigitte Bardot. But they were very disparaging of Jeanne Moreau. They said, your eyes are too big, you've got a downturned mouth, your cheeks don't fit with the studio lighting.
All the things that make her distinctive.
Exactly, eventually. And the thing was, but that lasted for about 10 years. And then in 1957, she was almost 30. So the cinema door was closing on her. And then miraculously, Peter Brook, the English theatre director, arrived in Paris and he managed a stage production of Tennessee Williams' Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, and he cast her as Maggie. And she was a sensation all over again. But this time there were young directors looking at her and they recognised in her what they wanted to portray: thoughtful, resourceful, defiant women. And that's when she became a star.
So first up, François Truffaut, the person who started the Nouvelle Vague.
Yeah. And it wasn't only Truffaut. It was really, really important directors like Jean-Luc Godard and Agnès Varda were at the vanguard of the Nouvelle Vague. And so when she became a star was in 1958, when Louis Malle, who had seen her on stage, cast her as the female lead in a terrific thriller called Lift the Scaffold. And there she plays a woman who conspires with her young lover to murder her very, very wealthy husband. We've heard that story very, very many times before, but the way Louis Malle made it, with a very, very small film crew in the streets of Paris at night, and we hear Miles Davis playing on the soundtrack. It's a legendary soundtrack because he improvised on seeing the film for the first time. They recorded that night with the band in the studio. And so you see Jeanne Moreau wandering around the streets at night in the half light of the city streets with her huge eyes. All of a sudden they're like headlights now because she's so fearful, and her downturned mouth starts to tremble. And then you can see a director recognising in her what other producers had failed to recognise. The next year, in 1959, she makes another movie with Louis Malle, which again extends the exploration of the female experience. It's a film called Les Amants. And there she played a woman who abandons her husband and her young child for her young lover. Now, this movie caused a sensation in the United States. It's very controversial because it was accused of pornography. But really, Kay, it just came down to the cold, hard fact that this is a film that dares to portray female sexuality on screen, specifically the female orgasm. And, you know,
this is Hicham Moreau with Moreau's her young lover.
That's correct. Yes. And so here was a case of Jeanne Moreau's needs as an actress not only coinciding with the needs of the directors of the Nouvelle Vague, but I think she went on to vent female emancipation in the early 60s with the burgeoning sexual revolution.
Now, let's go back to her childhood. Strange as it may seem, there is an Irish connection.
Would you believe it? Well, you couldn't. With a mother like Kathleen Buckley, that was her mother's name, she could only have been Irish or have an Irish connection. In actual fact, her mother was born in Lancashire, but she could trace her roots back to 1850s Mayo. So clearly, I would reckon that they left Ireland during the famine or thereabouts. And so Kathleen was born in Lancashire, as I said, and she was a member of the Tiller Girls, which would be the Lancashire version of the Rockettes. She was a chorus line dancer. And in 1927, the Tiller Girls went to tour in France and they ended up in the Folies Bergère in Paris. And that's where Kathleen met a chap called Anatole Moreau. And they met, she became pregnant, they got married, and Jeanne was born the next year. And unfortunately, the marriage was not a happy one, but it got even worse, primarily because his family didn't approve that he'd marry this chorus girl. And it got worse because when Jeanne was a teenage girl, she announced that she wanted to be an actress. Now, her mother, Kathleen, was very, very supportive, but her father, Anatole, kicked her out of the house. And sadly, despite her immense success and all the achievements throughout her career, he shunned her until shortly before his death in 1975. So that was one of the things perhaps that drove her defiance and resilience throughout her career.
So we have a clip of Moreau recounting her childhood, because obviously she was a child during World War II.
Yeah.
But very funnily, this period with no men but the army of occupation, we had a sense of freedom, all the girls, because there were no fathers, no... You know, only the women were working, trying to bring money and do things. But that didn't last long, of course, when the first girls, some of them didn't come back to school and some others came and they had the yellow star. Yeah, it was an incredible period.
There's Jeanne Moreau talking about her experience during World War II and how she saw her friends, her Jewish friends, suffer at that time. So can we get on to Jules and Jim, the famous film she did with François Truffaut?
It's probably her most famous film, her probably most famous role, Catherine, where she plays a woman who has a menage a trois with these two gentlemen, Jules and Jim. And I think I just want to relate it back to the way she told that story, that little vignette, because it's all about the emotional transition. She was able to move from something quite humorous into something really, really dark. And also then in her films, she was able to move from great darkness into moments of light. There's a fantastic sequence in Jules et Jim where she's regaling Jules and Jim with stories of her childhood. And as she does so, she strikes different facial expressions. And what Truffaut did then was he froze the image. He goes for freeze frames, five different freeze frames on her face to capture the different spirits that she was able to portray. And I think that's a case of her needs and her ability meeting the great needs and great abilities of a great director. But at the same time, Kay, she had an uncanny ability to turn down roles that were wrong for her, that everyone said, oh, it would have been fantastic. She said no to Stanley Kubrick. Not many people said no to Stanley Kubrick, but she also turned down the role of Mrs.
What was she offered?
She was offered the lead, the female lead in Spartacus opposite Kirk Douglas. But she also turned down the role of Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate. Mm-hmm. And you would have said, well, she would have been fantastic in that. But she knew the second she opened her mouth, the American audiences would have only have heard her French accent and immediately would have only have seen a nymphomaniac, as opposed to hearing the underlying emotional core value of what Mrs. Robinson was, tremblingly lonely. And that's what Jeanne Moreau said, no, I would be ruining the part and it would be bad for me. So she said no.
Let's listen to a little of her singing from Jules et Jim. And this is Le Troubillon.
Elle avait des bagues à chaque doigt, des tas de bracelets autour des poignets. Et puis elle chantait avec une voix qui cite au manjola. Elle avait des yeux d'opale qui me fascinaient, qui me fascinaient. Il y avait l'ovale de son visage pâle, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale, de femme fatale qui me fut fatale. Au
s'est connu, on s'est reconnu, on s'est perdu de vue, on s'est perdu de vue, on s'est retrouvé, on s'est réchauffé, puis on s'est séparé. Chacun pour soi est reparti dans le tourbillon de la vie. Je l'ai revu un soir, aïe aïe aïe, ça fait déjà un fameux bail, ça fait déjà un fameux bail.
There, Jeanne Moreau singing in Jules Agim. Stephen, what about her moving in then to writing and directing? Well, that's a difficult transition.
It is, and unusual, but I think it's logical in her case. So what she did with Jeanne Moreau, her first film Lumière, which was made in 1975, that focused on the friendships of four women, all of them actresses. And that was a turning point because it portrayed the friendships between women as opposed to the rivalries between women. So what Jeanne Moreau was actually doing was she was portraying women as women as opposed to what men thought women do behind closed doors when the men aren't present. And then she made a fantastic documentary, which was very, very hard to find, very, very rarely seen. It's a documentary on the great silent Hollywood actress Lillian Gish. And that typified what Jeanne Moreau loved in people, an inquisitive mind, an independence of thought and optimism. And I think that's borne right through Jeanne Moreau's life.
And she also had a singing career.
She did. She did. Clearly, the song from Jules Agim set that one on its way.
And we'll end this talk about Jeanne Moreau with her singing again. And this is called La Vie de Cocagne, which translates as The Life of Plenty.
Je rêve toujours de me tirer, de me barrer, de me tailler, de foutre le camp. Moi qu'aimerais tant m'arrêter de cavaler, prendre le temps. D'avoir des chats, des petits chats, des chiens, des tas d'enfants. Un vieux fauteuil au coin du feu où me laisser glisser à deux. Avoir mes bouquins sous la main qui s'ouvrent d'eux-mêmes. Aux pages que l'on aime et qu'on relit sans fin parce qu'on les aime. Un petit clocher de Cocagne que j'entendrai tinter l'hiver tout comme l'été, la nuit, le jour sur la campagne.
Jeanne Moreau there singing us how Jeanne Moreau died in 2017 at the age of 89. Before I let you go, Stephen Benedict, news came today of Hollywood director Wolfgang Petersen had passed away at the age of 81.
Yeah.
Came to fame with his work in 1981, the World War II movie Das Boot.
Yeah, that's been set on board a German U-boat. Now, I think the thing to remember about that film is Petersen actually delivered the inconceivable thing. He made the Nazi Navy sympathetic. And he did so by delivering something that had very, very rarely, if ever, been depicted on U-boats or submarines before, how bloody claustrophobic and how bloody boring it can be. And it was the grind. It wasn't the derring do of Run Silent, Run Deep. It wasn't the Hollywood sort of those sort of pictures. This was the grind and the sweatiness and the smell of cabbage and the smell of urine. It was really, really difficult. He received two Oscar nominations off that picture. And then he was beckoned to Hollywood. He made a film that's often forgotten, brilliant children's film called The Neverending Story. It's absolutely magical. His most famous film from Hollywood era would probably be In the Night of Fire, starring Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich. That received, I think, two Oscar nominations. And then he went on to direct the great action picture with Harrison Ford, Air Force One. But after that, sort of things sort of tapered off. They weren't all great pictures in Hollywood, but those are the ones that I mentioned are the best.
Well, thank you for that, Stephen. And let's finish with a clip now from In the Line of Fire, which was from 1993. Here, Frank, played by Clint Eastwood, recalls his failure as a Secret Service agent back in November 63 when JFK was assassinated.
God, that was a beautiful day. Son of God. Been raining all morning. The air was first shot. Sound like a firecracker. I looked over and I saw him. I could tell he was hit. Don't know why I didn't react. I should have reacted. I should have been running flat out. I just couldn't believe it. If only I reacted, I could could have taken that shot. That would have been all right with me.
Clint Eastwood in The Line of Fire, which was directed by Wolfgang Petersen, who has passed away at the age of 81. Bones in the Attic is an exhibition at the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin. It's a group exhibition of 10 female artists and the collective known as Na Cailleacha. It explores stigma in relation to women, questioning why, even now, certain women, the single woman, the childless woman, the ageing woman, are all dismissed with fear, pity and horror. The artists include Rita Duffy, Eleanor McCaughey, Jessie Jones and Ruby Wallace. Jessica Fahey has been to see the exhibition for Arena and joins me now. We have some images from the exhibition, which we will tweet as we go along. Jessica, this exhibition offers work visitors from the Hugh Lane will be quite familiar with, and then some new or newer work or some work they haven't seen in some time. When we go into the exhibition, first we meet Rita Duffy's work called Sofa, an image which we will tweet now. Can you explain how, you know, how it fits into the context of the exhibition and maybe describe it to us?
Yes, Kay. So essentially the idea was to have an exhibition of sort of intergenerational works, to have as many voices and as many different outlooks to be included. So for something like the Sofa, for, you know, anyone who's interested in Irish art, and in particular 20th century Irish art, it's quite an exciting work to get to see it in person again, because it, you know, is the type of thing that's, I suppose, usually in storage. So to see something like that, that is all about the materiality of it. So it's a, you know, life-size sofa, like a two-seater sofa. And from a distance, it looks like it's going to be sort of fluffy and furry, almost like a soft kind of soft toy or something along those lines. And as you examine it closer, you realise that actually the sofa has all of these little hairpins sticking out of it. So something that should be very comfortable, very cosy, very relaxing, all of a sudden is uncomfortable. And this makes us think about that kind of, you know, juxtaposition that then allows us to think about, well, what might it be like to have, you know, representation of your domesticity be something actually painful, uncomfortable, like these little pins sticking into you all of the time. So it's the type of work that I think is very striking as soon as you see it, and then opens up even more the closer you examine it. So getting to see it in person is fantastic.
Yes, yes, I was at the exhibition and I was so excited to see it. It's so creepy.
It is.
Other work the viewers will be familiar with is Kathy Prendergast's Waiting from 1980, Dorothy Cross's Wonderful Shark Lady from 1988, and then drawings by Alice Marr. Talking to My Hair is one of them. We'll tweet an image of that now. Can you recall that drawing for us, please?
Yes, absolutely. So it has a sort of fairy tale feel to it, almost kind of a distorted Alice in Wonderland, this little girl in a dress with a bow on, and her hair is growing out from her head and then going across in front of her and down to the ground. And Alice Marr was sort of looking at the idea of sort of conversations in these particular drawings, or etchings as they are, and the idea of having sort of conversation with a kind of monster version of your hair, again, makes us think about a lot of the issues and ideas surrounding the relationship between women and their hair and their identity in their hair. And the idea that we can be vastly different depending on a haircut. Now, it goes much deeper than that, of course. And she, throughout her career, has used hair as a way of examining these ideas, not just of women's identity today, but the various fairy tales and Rapunzels and different figures where the hair then starts to become something barbaric or a chance of escape. All these different ways that hair have been interpreted in terms of feminine identity over time.
You talked in the Rita Duffy about that upending of the kind of domestic space by using this kind of grotesque sofa. Sarah Jane Booth is another very interesting artist who uses a kind of very fragile domestic space and then again upends it. We'll tweet an image from Sarah Jane Booth as well. Jessica.
Sorry, yes. So yes, her series of works is given the title For All Our Grievous Doings. So essentially she is looking at I suppose why women have been considered to be at fault for such a long time. If you think about even some of the very early ideas in Christianity, the idea of, you know, Eve being the one who takes the apple from the tree or the fruit from the tree. And then it isn't until the 14th century that you've writers kind of trying to reevaluate that and sort of say, well, surely seeking knowledge is a good thing, and that Eve was able to convince Adam to do it means that he's the weaker one. But for the most part, it's been seen as women being the disruptive force, the other, the problematic one. So Sarah Jane Booth does very interesting things with a variety of different, very unusual and again, surprising kind of objects throughout her installation, which is multi-layered, really. And the one that we're looking at now is a small little figurine, which has a very sort of delicate looking woman wearing a white dress with sort of gold trim and holding a small child. But also in front of her face, you can just about make out that the artist has inserted a little text of Married Love by Maria Stopes, who was the author of this very famous book in 1918, which was the first time that it very openly discussed the need for contraception and the birth control and also the need for sexual fulfillment for women in marriage. And it was always sort of known as this dirty book. So to have that in, you know, in contrast then to this delicate, pretty image of femininity, again, raises a really interesting question.
The exhibition also explores intergenerational conflict. Sorrow Had a Baby was the video there, and I thought that that was a very powerful film by Myra Carton, where she, like, she has a long interview with her mother and shows, has lots of images of her mother, and she is a child and talking about her mother and addiction problems, eating problems she has in some ways inherited in the family.
Yeah, so not everything, of course, when you're looking at, you know, identity is going to be positive. The version of the mother as a perfect person is a very problematic thing as well. So to have that kind of examination where we get to see how complex it is and how, you know, we are all, you know, sort of seeking out individuality and identity, but we're also still related to all the women that went before us, those that are directly related to us. And again, those that are not, that are the stories that are told or the figures from the past. So again, it just brings, as I say, all these different voices and different ways of perceiving women in society and, of course, women in art, because we are, of course, looking at women artists and their expression.
Now, one room of the exhibition is given over to the Kailaka, a collective of female artists. How do they address the themes of the exhibition?
So they're a fantastic group, I think, because they are a group of women who claim to have over, I think, 500 years of experience based on their each individual age. And they came together, not just visual artists, but composers, curators, to really sort of, I suppose, celebrate and examine the position of the female artist in Ireland or woman artist in Ireland. One of the things that they do that's represented in this particular exhibition is they had a project called the Doll Project or Child's Play, where they each of the visual artists made a sort of alter ego using bed sheets of themselves and created a doll, mostly almost life size. And in doing this, you know, brought back sort of ideas of their own creativity as children, of making your own enjoyment, but also this idea of, I suppose, acting out and playing and what you can learn about yourself in doing so. The other thing I think that's really sort of fascinating about it as well is that when we think about the idea of the doll and how young girls predominantly are trained to be grown-up women, either by having Barbie dolls or baby dolls or whatever it may be, that this again sort of sparks off a kind of interesting conversation, particularly with one of the dolls as well that's an exhibition that looks a little bit like the Venus of Willendorf, which is a very old example of a fertility symbol, and again how these kind of talismanic objects can work in terms of feminine identity as well.
Now, and the image we're tweeting here is of Gerda Tilger's doll Maeve.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the photograph has her sort of out in the field. She's again made from white sheets. In this case, she has long hair and she's wearing wellies. You can actually see the actual doll in the exhibition, and the wellies are bright red and the hair is sort of red and yellow, giving it this sort of fiery kind of personality. But also, I think, again, injecting a little bit of humour into it with the wellies, I think, in particular. And then, of course, the relationship with Maeve and an Irish tradition of a strong queen and leader, although, of course, her flaws are also very evident in the story of the coolest story. So we have an exploration of those identities through one artist's expression through the creation of a doll as an alter ego. And we can, in our own experience of the exhibition, sort of ask those questions of ourselves too, as to, you know, what sort of doll you'd make of yourself if you were asked to do so.
I thought it was a bit ironic when I was leaving the Kailaka's room that you walk straight into Sean Scully's room and you think, oh, the big beast still exists. Yes. There with his monumental work, and then you have the group exhibition of women. Maybe it would have been nice if they creeped into him and upset his lair a little bit.
I think it's actually part of the donation that he has to be on display for 30 years. So it's a bit of perhaps artistic manspreading in that case there, because they're massive paintings as well. But upstairs, luckily, I think it's a fantastic thing to have the two at once. Upstairs is the Eva Gonzalez exhibition that traces the evidence of incredible female artists throughout Western art history, which again matches so well with the one downstairs, because it does show us that one of the issues that women artists have always faced is being forgotten or silenced. They did exist even against all odds, but aren't necessarily given all the same attention. And you can see that with Nikailika's statement poster in the middle of their display as well, which is based on a Guerrilla Girls poster from the 1980s as well, in relation to, you know, how difficult it has been for women artists, but that they have existed.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for going to Bones in the Attic, and that runs at the Hugh Lane Gallery, Dublin, from the 11th of August to the 30th of October. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan.